The audacity of hope, the U.S. boat in the Gaza Freedom Flotilla makes a break for freedom out of the harbor in Athens. It's quickly intercepted by the Greek Coast Guard and escorted into a naval base where it's now trapped. The Greek government has officially made it clear that it's enforcing Israel's blockade and has instructed its Coast Guard and Navy to use all available means to prevent flotilla boats from leaving its shores. The Tahrir is no different. Its passengers have been ready for a week. Its paperwork is in order. It's passed the extraordinary safety checks imposed by the Greek authorities, and its fuel tanks are full. But still, it's going nowhere. Organisers of the Canadian boat say they're using all available avenues to get their boat freed. They plan to challenge the government's order over the next few days through legal and direct action.
We are exploring every single avenue we can think of. So obviously there's the legal avenue, because that order to ground our ship make no sense whatsoever. We are also trying to make political pressure, and we are also looking to all our technical alternative, let's say.
And the vast majority of passengers on board the Tahrir are ready to wait it out. Their determination still palpable.
International institutions, the Egyptian government, the Arab League, the UN have failed to support the Palestinians' human rights. And I think it's people that will break the siege of Gaza, and it's the flotilla which is at the crest of that.
I come from a Jewish background, and my parents were refugees from the Nazi Holocaust. For me, that background is a strong humanist, internationalist set of values that say never again for anybody.
Earlier, the passengers rallied through the town of Agios Nikolas in Crete, where the boat is docked, to express their fury at the government's decision.
This is shame on the Greek government, it's shame on the EU, it's shame on the Canadian and American government, because they're all kowtowing to one power which is trying to tell them where their citizens can travel, what their ships can do.
And despite their government's position, many Greeks support the effort.
The Greek government is following the orders of Israel on this issue. It has broken the friendship with Palestinians and Arabs that has existed for many years and has gone against the feeling of the Greek people.
Greece's strong statement on enforcing the blockade has revealed Israel's hidden hand behind the bureaucracy and technicalities the ships had faced, and the flotilla's hopes that the Greek government wouldn't obstruct its mission, given the Greek people's history of opposition to imperialism and support for Palestine, has fallen by the wayside. But the passengers say too much hope, love and finance has been invested by millions around the world to give up now.
A Canadian and an Irish boat quietly left a Turkish port on Wednesday, bound for Gaza. Democracy Now! First broke the news on our live broadcast on Wednesday. This flotilla marks the latest attempt by international activists to break the Israeli naval blockade of Gaza. Earlier this year, Greece blocked the departure of several ships from another flotilla heading to the region. In 2010, Israeli forces killed 9 Turkish activists, including a U.S. citizen, on an aid boat called the Mavi Marmara, which was part of the first such international flotilla. Well, this latest flotilla, with the 2 boats, is called Freedom Waves to Gaza. The Canadian boat is called Tahrir, Arabic for liberation. And the Irish boat is called Saoirse, Irish for freedom. Before they set sail, David Heap, one of the Canadian activists on board the Tahrir, explained the name of the flotilla.
Coming out of the second Freedom Flotilla, we're calling what the current departure Freedom Waves to Gaza, because rather than thinking of it as separate, countable waves that you can call 1, 2, and 3, we're really thinking of it more as continuous waves of human solidarity, continuous waves of people intent on challenging the blockade in different ways, coming from different countries, from different ports, different groups of boats, whenever they're ready to go to challenge the blockade in a way which is less predictable than an annual flotilla, but also more creative.
We go right now to a video report. The boats are now sailing through international waters. Democracy Now! Correspondent Jihan Hafiz is on board.
It's an emotional moment for activists who spent weeks planning a secret mission to Gaza. After numerous setbacks and complications, an international delegation prepared to set off from a coastal town in southwestern Turkey in hopes of challenging Israel's siege of the Gaza Strip. The activists on board the Irish and Canadian boats dubbed Freedom Waves to Gaza organized under unusual circumstances compared to previous convoys to Gaza. Activists concealed all information about the flotilla from the public. A media embargo was in place for journalists invited to cover the event. Video journalists were not allowed to take out their cameras until the boat's departure. David Heap, a member of the steering committee on the Canadian boat, the Tahrir, explains.
The cameras are just coming out now because we were keeping it very quiet and discreet before our departure because we didn't want to attract attention to it. We didn't want to put the Turkish authorities in a difficult position, so our departure was just as a private pleasure vessel. There was a discrepancy between what our ship's papers say in terms of the International Naval Survey Board and what we're allowed to carry. We're certified to carry up to 50 people. They have a regulation that a private pleasure vessel can only take up to 12 people, including the captain, so very reluctantly we reduced our delegation, our carefully chosen international delegation, and left 24 of our friends behind, but they're all with us supporting the fact that we're departing. It's not about us, it's about the Palestinians of Gaza.
Karen DeVito, a member of the Canadian delegation, attempted to reach Gaza from Greece this past summer before Greek authorities, under pressure from the Israeli and U.S. governments, intercepted the boats before they could reach international waters.
It almost seemed like a replay of what happened this summer when we were unable to sail. That was a manifestation that the blockade has been outsourced. And that was very, very disappointing. This time, we had to leave some people behind. That's heartbreaking, to leave our colleagues behind. It's a bittersweet moment. But we really want to bring attention to the fact that ordinary people everywhere should be able to live in peace and in the presence of justice and without fear in their everyday lives and without fear overall that they're going to be invaded, occupied.
These boxes were labeled as food, but they are actually filled with medical supplies. The Canadian vessel is taking $30,000 worth of medical supplies to Gaza, along with personal letters from Canadian citizens addressed to the residents of the besieged territory. Although the Turkish Coast Guard followed closely behind the Canadian and Irish vessels, both boats made it out to international waters safely and began the long journey to Gaza. The main obstacle now that could prevent both boats from reaching their final destination is the Israeli response. In May of last year, Israeli commandos killed 9 activists when the first flotilla tried to sail to Gaza. Activists say they have trained in nonviolent resistance in the event the Israelis board the vessels. Kit Kittredge is the only American delegate. She says those on board are trained in nonviolent resistance and are prepared for the possibility the Israelis intercept the boat.
We just reached international waters, so I'm ecstatic. And I also anticipate that the Israeli army, probably the Navy, is probably considering boarding us at some point on our way to Gaza and the siege. And I'm not feeling fearful. I'm feeling actually pretty peaceful, and that's what we are. We are a peaceful boat and a peaceful flotilla going to end the siege.
As news of the flotilla continued to circulate throughout the night, Israeli forces announced their Navy is prepared to block the boats from reaching Gaza's shores. To prevent a possible assault by Israeli forces in the evening, organizers are planning for both boats to reach Gaza's territorial borders during daylight hours. In the meantime, both vessels sail freely into open waters. Jahan Hafiz for Democracy Now! On the Tahrir en route to Gaza.
And we are joined right now by Jahan Hafiz, who is on board the Tahrir. That's the Canadian boat, part of the two-boat flotilla headed to Gaza right now in international waters. We'll see if we can hear her clearly. Jahan, are you there? Jahan, are you there? Jahan, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm hearing me.
Ah, very good.
If yes,
you,
I'm here.
If you could
yes,
just tell
hear,
us
can you
the
hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine. Can you tell us the latest report from where you are in international waters? You're on the Tahrir, the Canadian boat. The other boat that is alongside of you, the Irish boat, have you made contact yet? And what are your plans, the group's plans, on the two boats at this point?
Yes, for the first time today, actually since this trip was planned, the delegations from the Canadian boat were able to make physical contact with the Irish boats. As we've been sailing, it's been the waters have been very rough here, so they haven't been able to board the boat, and we haven't been able to board their vessel. However, the plan is to continue the voyage, to continue this voyage to Gaza, regardless of the threats coming from the Israeli government. And in fact, both teams met today to hold meetings with the journalists and delegates on board to discuss a strategy for when the Israelis do intercept the boat, if they intercept the boat, and what will take place from there. We're about 150 to 170 kilometers off the coast of Gaza. It'll take us about another day and a half to get there. As I mentioned in the report, the activists and the organizers of both flotillas do not want to reach Gaza's borders, at least the territorial region, until daylight. They do not want to have a similar situation to what happened to the Mavi Marmara. That boat was attacked in the evening, and they want to avoid any kind of misperception about violence if violence is committed. As mentioned in the report as well, there's also a commitment to nonviolent resistance. There was training for that today on the boat to make sure that if we do come in contact with the Israelis, there will be no confrontation from those on either boats. Aside from that, the spirits have been very high.
Jihan, is there a boat that is following you?
At the moment, there is not. There was last night, up until 4 o'clock in the morning on our side, there was an unidentified boat that was following us. The only other boat that followed us out of international waters was the Turkish Coast Guard. So from the boat, we all presumed it was the Turkish Coast Guard, but there's no longer anyone following us. It's only the Irish boat and the Canadian open waters.
Jihan, you took us on a tour of the boat you are on, the Tahrir, and we met some of the activists on board, Canadian, Australian. There's a U.S. citizen on board as well. Who's on the Irish boat?
These are solely Irish delegates. Some of them are former members of parliament. We haven't been able to sit down and speak with them, but we do know that there are 3 to 5 on board who are former members of parliament. Also, they're a group that has continuously made efforts through different initiatives to reach Gaza, and we haven't been able to speak with them, but they have been to Gaza a number of times before, some of the delegates, and they plan this on their own and in close coordination with the steering committee here. However, we have not been in touch with them at all. They've sort of been on their own in this journey, mainly because of the waters, but also because of the secrecy of the planning of this. So it's mainly an Irish delegation. I also want to mention that the Canadian boat was restricted to 12 people out of the 36 who were meant to come along on the Tahrir, the Canadian boat. Only 12 were allowed on, whereas the Irish boats, they only allowed them to have 12 on, but they snuck some people on their boats. And so the entire Irish delegation that came to Turkey to make this voyage to Gaza is present, and they're heading in that direction now. We have supporters from this boat are still in Turkey. Some returned home, and they're working on logistical work as well as media work to communicate with people on the boat. The internet hasn't been precise at times. It goes out every now and then. But there is a lot of international support from the organizations represented on this boat, as well as the Irish one, including a number of committees around the world that are supporting what these freedom waves to Gaza are, essentially an extension of the Free Gaza movement, which is a movement to break the siege by any means and at any cost.
Is there fear on board your boat, the Tahrir, the Canadian boat that you are covering? There are 12 people on board the boat, is that right? The captain, 6 activists, and 5 journalists.
Yes, there is concern. I wouldn't say fear. I think people here are defiant in that they believe in what they're doing, and they believe that what they're doing is peaceful, and that they will, even if there is any kind of the Israelis do board the boat or intercept the boat, there will not be any resistance, any violent confrontation from any of the activists here. So the concern is mainly losing a lot of their equipment. Some people came here with their cell phones, their laptops. I have camera equipment here. So there's a lot of concern about if we do get detained on international waters, what will become of our personal items, but as well, what will happen when we're in detention, how long will we stay there? And there are some Arabs on this boat, and they expressed a deep concern that they could be detained by Arabs, and they, possibly their legal rights will not be respected the way the international delegates will be. And so there are legal teams now working on the ground in the United States and in Canada to ensure that those who have either visa issues or who are concerned about being detained by the Israelis will have full legal rights in the event that something that the Israelis do board the boat.
Jihan Hafiz, I want to thank you for being with us, reporting for Democracy Now! On board the Tahrir. That's the Canadian boat, one of two boats in what they're calling the Freedom Waves to Gaza flotilla that set sail yesterday from Turkey, bound for Gaza.
Welcome to the July 17th edition of This Week in Palestine on WZBC 90.3 FM, a weekly show hosted for many years by our beloved Sharif Fahm and continued in his loving memory by his friends. I'm your host, Despina Moutsouris, and on today's show, we continue our conversation on the power of grassroots nonviolent resistance to stand up against violence, oppression, and injustice. We'll be speaking shortly with Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, based in Chicago. Kathy is a longtime peace activist and co-coordinator of this campaign to end U.S. and military economic warfare. As a co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, she helped form 70 delegations from 1996 to 2003 that openly defied sanctions by bringing medicines to children and families in Iraq. Kathy and her companions lived in Baghdad throughout the Shock and Awe bombing campaign. In 2010, she made three trips to Afghanistan, helping to connect U.S. peace activists with Afghan youth peace volunteers and other representatives of civil society. In the spring of 2011, she joined a delegation to Afghanistan again to join Afghan youth peace volunteers in their campaign, Live Without Wars. She's also visited Pakistan twice since 2009 and was part of a small delegation that reported from Gaza during Israel's brutal Operation Cast Lead assault. Kathy was sentenced in the past to 1 year in federal prison for planting corn on nuclear missile silo sites between 1988 and 1989. She spent 3 months in Peking prison in 2004 for crossing the line at Fort Benning's military training school. As a tax refuser, Kathy has not paid federal income taxes since 1980. She and her companions in Chicago believe nonviolence necessarily involves simplicity, service, sharing of resources, and nonviolent direct action in resistance to war and oppression. If you'd like to find out more about the work of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, you can visit their website at www.vcnv.org. And welcome back to This Week in Palestine. And thank you, Kathy, for joining us so early on a Sunday morning.
Thank you, Despina.
You're welcome. I'd like to start our conversation today by asking you, what motivated you to participate recently in the Gaza Flotilla and in the Welcome to Palestine campaign, and how does these experiences relate to other journeys you've taken in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and other parts of the world?
Well, you know, any time that you leave a war zone and you've got the blue American passport and you know you're going back to safety and security, there's an unsettling feeling, and there should be. Why should I be the one that gets safety and security? And I had been in Gaza during the final days of the Operation Cast Lead assault, and it was horrible. The infrastructure was reduced to rubble in many places, and civilian homes had been hit, and hospitals, and mosques, and universities. And I remember a doctor from the burn unit, his name was Dr. Nafiz Abu Shabhab, put his head in his hands, and he said, the world watched for 22 days, and no country did anything. Well, that was true. But I think since that time, and also with the horrible shock of the Mavi Marmara and the execution on the deck of people and also helicopter gunships shooting at civilians, international civil society has reflected in the formation of the flotilla project that they can't just watch and sit on their hands and pretend that we're not aware of what's going on. And so I think the flotilla, the International Flotilla Project, from its inception years ago and throughout the very persistent and hard work that's been required to form these international flotillas, has shown that international civil society is prepared to try to take action. And so I very much wanted to be a part of this. Now, I'm really glad that you are asking this difficult question of how does this compare with other countries, because, I mean, really for years my focus was almost entirely on the economic sanctions against Iraq. And certainly those economic sanctions were the most comprehensive economic sanctions ever imposed in modern history. But I felt that, you know, those of us who had focused so much on the economic sanctions against Iraq ought not to ignore what was happening in Gaza. But one difference was that it was possible, it wasn't easy, but it was possible to enter into Iraq and to travel in various parts of the country. We were always kind of under the thumb of Saddam Hussein's dictatorship. But I think one of the exacerbating causes of misery in Gaza is that people cannot enter in and out. And the Rafah border crossing opening doesn't seem to make much of a difference. I just talked to a young friend from Rafah yesterday, and he said he sees almost no difference whatsoever in terms of people being able to come and go. And I've also recently been to Afghanistan four times in the past year. And I guess I should say that in Afghanistan, the poverty is so lethal that 850 children die every single day. But I think that it's understandable that young people in Afghanistan have formed such an affinity with some of the young people they've spoken with by Skype phone calls and through the internet in Gaza, because they likewise feel trapped, they feel imprisoned. And of course, the reality in any of the countries that I visited is that the media doesn't portray what it's like for the people who are bearing the brunt of these wars, both military and economic. You just don't get the sense of what it's like to be trapped and unable to protect your children and unable to construct a better life for yourselves because of the constant war making. And people aren't responsible for having done anything to affect the people of the United States, and yet we're the ones who are helping supply these arsenals for the Israeli government. We're very implicated. And most people in the United States barely even know what the consequences of our economic development are.
And that's very ironic that there's some mobility in war zones like Afghanistan and Pakistan, yet in Gaza, no one can get in. It's almost hermetically sealed by the Israeli government, of course, with complicity of our government and European governments. Having said that, can you describe some of the highlights of your recent trip during the flotilla and in your attempt to enter Israel?
Well, I was very impressed with the people, both those who had organized the flotilla and those who were helping to get our effort afloat and setting sail. I was particularly impressed by Anne Wright. She is a force to contend with in the best possible sense of the word. She brings all of her skills in terms of diplomacy and organizing and analysis and writing, and is a tremendous motivator and animator. Pulls out the best in people. So it was a real privilege to watch her. I also was impressed that Mustafa al-Barghouti came to visit us when we were on the boat. We were at this point stuck, docked in a military harbor. The Greeks had forced our ship back, and the captain was still in jail, and it was looking pretty bleak, to tell you the truth. And he came and sat with us, and this was a real privilege to hear from him and to hear his upbeat report. He's really looking forward to September as being a time that might make a real difference as the people of Palestine petition for statehood at the United Nations and the General Assembly. It was important for me to be part of the fast across from the United States Embassy. At that point, we were certainly fasting for freedom for Gazans. We were fasting to free our boat and also to free the captain of the boat, who was still in jail. And we were arrested by Greek police, I think, on orders from the United States Embassy because we didn't want to leave this small space that we were occupying across from the embassy. But then on July 4th, Spanish activists who also were unable to set sail because the Greek government had imposed bureaucratic procedures that prevented their boat from leaving. They went into their embassy, and they refused to leave. They were inside the embassy. They more or less occupied it. And it was so amazing because when I went over to see the Spaniards in their embassy, it looked like an opera scene. You know, they're occupying the balconies of the embassy. They're looking out on the Acropolis. They've got their flags festooning and their banners hanging in the front of the embassy. And there was one Greek security guard working to kind of protect the embassy. That was it. And it was clear that they didn't need any more security. There wasn't any possible hint of a threat that this was a political action, but it wasn't a violent action. Well, over at the U.S. Embassy, there's a long line of cars from the employees who work inside the embassy, and they all have to be examined one by one to see if there's anything attached underneath that might be an explosive, and they've got Brinks guards, and they've got Greek police, and the place is fortified, and it's got spike walls, and it just looks like a huge military compound. And this is true of U.S. embassies around the world. Now, why? I think it's because the practices of the United States, and in the case of its alliance with Israel, are unsustainable, and they occasion so much antagonism that people in other parts of the world are angry at people in the United States and at our representatives in other parts of the world. So we held that fast for 3 days across from the embassy. And I should also say that at no point did anybody from the U.S. embassy until 5 days had passed go and visit this U.S. citizen, the captain of the boat who had been placed in jail because the boat had left the Greek port. Now, why did the boat leave the Greek port? You know, two of those boats in the flotilla had been sabotaged, and there was every reason to expect that if you sat around and waited, eventually your turn would come along. And so a Greek independent judiciary team, when the captain finally did go before the judges, ruled that he was right in believing that he better kind of make a break for it and leave that port, and so he was freed without needing to pay any bail, and the major charges were all dropped.
And that's good to hear. And recently also has been reported that no one from the U.S. consulate has visited the Audacity of Hope in the harbor either, and the electricity has been cut off, and they're basically just three women there, you know, stranded with no support or even acknowledgement from their government. It's just, you know, simply to make a visit to say, okay, are you still alive? Are you okay? Is there something that you need? It's almost as if they're just abandoned to their fate.
Well, and with 100-degree temperatures, initially there were six women and four of them over 60 and sweltering on that boat. And we've been calling the State Department very constantly and trying to clamor for some kind of encouragement to the Greek government to restore shore power and at least let people have electricity. But it's really a shame that they were treated as though they were non-people. It's not too late to call the State Department. One of the reasons we were thinking it's a good idea to call today is because Hillary Clinton is in Greece, and so it would be a good idea to encourage Hillary Clinton to speak out, although I think that her views on the flotilla were made clear when she suggested that this was a provocative action.
Now, there were several opinions given as to what motivated the Greek government to take the actions that it took to sabotage the flotilla efforts, and there have also been viewpoints expressed about a dichotomy between the reactions of the Greek people and versus the Greek government. Myself, I am a dual national. I'm a citizen of both Greece and the U.S., so I follow that quite closely in the press over there, and I want to know what were the reactions of the Greek people to your flotilla, and what do you think actually motivated the Greek government to take the actions that it took on behalf of Israel?
Well, of course, the development that's happening within Athens in the square called Syntagma Square is a brilliant demonstration of democracy at work. And people come together and have an assembly at 9 o'clock at night, and various affinity groups are well represented. It's really quite organized, and people have been occupying that square for many weeks. And our sense is that there's huge support for ending the siege against Gaza and for international civil society to take actions, and that the Greek society in general was so supportive of the flotilla effort in the past that that's why so many of the ships were planning to leave from the ports in Greece. The Greek government has been engaging in joint military operations with the Israeli army, and to their governance, this is seen as a big plus. I think that the competition, in a sense, between Greece and Turkey over the years has been affected now because some of the attentiveness that was given to perhaps tourism that could be steered toward Greece, or cooperation with tourism that could be steered toward Turkey, has now been directed toward Greece. There's a kind of a carrot that's been held out by the Israeli government: cooperate with us, and we can make life more advantageous for you. But also, the Greek government is right now in terrible straits financially. They've had draconian measures imposed on them. I mean, worse than what the most Republican hawk in the United States might ever imagine in terms of austerity measures that might be a consequence of the United States economy failing. And it's looking so bleak in the days ahead. And so the Greek government survived a no-confidence vote, and it looks as though they're wanting to be, I think, even subservient to the demands of other governments that could harm them, that could do even more to inflict punishment on Greece if it doesn't go along with demands that are being made of it by the IMF and the World Bank, and I think by governments like that of the United States and Israel, which have now congratulated the Greek government and thanked the Greek government for going along with Israel's effort to stop the flotilla from oversailing. I mean, I should also mention, I'm from Illinois, Senator Mark Kirk, for reasons I can't quite understand, called on U.S. Special Forces to cooperate with the Israeli government in disabling the flotilla.
In addition to that, also, Israel, very similar to the actions that it's taken in the United States, has also tried to ingratiate itself with Europe for many years, I'd say probably even for decades, to see itself as like an outpost of European civilization in the Middle East. And in addition to the reasons that you mentioned, the economic situation, closer military cooperation, in the case of Greece, also closer economic cooperation, talks about a pipeline and so forth, I think that there's also like a ideological collusion here with Zionism, because one of the things that the Israelis continually promote is how they're like a bulwark against fanatics in the Arab and the Muslim world. And unfortunately, on one level, I do believe that the Greek government and even some Greek people do collude with that particular sense. What's your response to that?
Well, that may be one of the reasons why the government of Israel was almost panicked at the thought of people trying to come to Israel with the flotilla. There were many efforts on the part of people from France and from Spain, from the United Kingdom. I participated myself coming over from Greece to enter into Israel and say very clearly, this is why I'm coming. And in the past, people have tried to finesse entrance into the country by giving any reason other than to say, I'm going because I want to be in solidarity with people in the West Bank and Gaza. Well, if people were part of this effort to join in the Welcome to Palestine campaign, and they were known to be traveling for that purpose, they were stopped in the European capitals. They weren't even allowed to board the plane. I was able to get on a flight leaving Athens, but I was wearing a T-shirt that said, USA Boat to Gaza. I had not said one word, and I was pulled out of the line.
The T-shirt got
t-shirt.
You into trouble.
Yeah, and I was deported within 3 hours. So I think that it's a difficult reality when, another country doesn't have even a tiny fraction of your military strength, and that's the case with regard to Gaza and the West Bank and Israel. People in Gaza and the West Bank have not even a tiny fraction of the weapon strength of Israel. But I would say that Israel has not even a tiny fraction of the moral grounding of people who are trapped in Gaza right now. The Israeli government doesn't want to have that reality exposed. And that's what projects like the Flotilla, or if you will, the Flytilla, but many, many other projects that have been going on are trying to expose that. You know, going back to that Operation Cast Lead, I certainly believe we must all feel remorse and regret for every family that's ever been traumatized or experienced bereavement in the villages that border Gaza, in Sidero and other places where rocket attacks have happened. But the disproportionate capacity of the Israeli government to kill and to destroy, which has been exercised, is appalling. I mean, there were at least 1,350 people killed. Over 300 of them were children in that Operation Cast Lead. And there were 11 people killed on the Israeli side, four of them Israeli soldiers killed by friendly fire. So what do you do with that kind mm-hmm. of overwhelming capacity to kill that gets exercised again and again? It happened in 2006 in the Hezbollah-Israeli summer war of 2006. Many of us who've been in the West Bank while villages or towns have been under siege and bombardment have seen this happen. I was in the Jenin camp in 2002, and 103-story buildings were completely destroyed. You know, people were sifting through the rubble trying to find the remains of their loved ones, and this goes on and on and on. And I think that there's certainly a desire on the part of the Israeli government to say that that they're the representatives of democracy and mm-hmm. and ethical behavior, but it's simply not borne out in their actions.
Right. Ultimately, what do you believe that Israel is afraid of? Why does it go to such extreme lengths to silence dissent and prevent any kind of truth about the reality of Gaza or Palestine or Palestinians?
Well, I think that this is a question that has to look backwards to the horrible history of the Holocaust and the persecution of Jewish people through many centuries. I think there's a sense that on the part of people who rise into governance of Israel that they have to hold the line, that they're responsible, that if they waver, then they'll leave the state vulnerable to people who feel hatred and would want to persecute Israelis. And of course, the terrible reality is that the more that Israel behaves as a menacing and a threatening and an unfair international outlaw, the more there is going to be a feeling of and justifiable antagonism that people will hold. And so I think that they're basically digging their grave, and maybe they know it, and that with that comes a terrible fear. But it doesn't have to go that way. I mean, I think that there's so many groups within Israel who have a much different vision, and it gets silenced and distanced from the mainstream. But you've got groups like the Israeli Coalition Against Housing Demolition, the Yesh Gavul, the Refuseniks, the Commandos for Peace, who refuse to serve in the Israeli Defense Forces, and when they go out and speak, will only go out and speak if they've got a Palestinian at their side. There are many, many people, I think, within Israel who could hold forth a different vision that's grounded on rationality and real courage.
What do you think are the accomplishments of the flotilla, despite the fact that you did not reach Gaza, even though there are still some ships that are attempting to go to Gaza today?
Well, and we should, of course, remember that people still have the ships. I think, you know, the U.S. boat to Gaza had anticipated that the Israelis would board the boat and confiscate the boat, so it's not the end of flotilla actions. I think that a major accomplishment was that there was more exposure of Israel's refusal to allow people to enter into Gaza or even into the West Bank, and the plight of the people in Gaza, where there's such a huge difficulty in reconstructing because it's being treated almost as a huge open-air prison, and where doctors are sounding the alarm and saying we're running out of medicines, where the rate of unemployment is up around 65%. I think that these are awarenesses that are much more broadly shared, and that's because of the summer activity of the flotilla.
Recently on the Electronic Intifada, in fact, I think it was just a few days ago, there was an article written by an Israeli-American freelance journalist, and she opined that actions like the flotilla and the involvement of international activists in the Welcome to Palestine campaign often unintentionally drown out real Palestinian voices by focusing, you know, on the situation and the chaos that's created when Israel attempts to block these activists. Do you agree or disagree with this view? Do you sometimes think that unintentionally you may actually silence the very voices that you're trying to give a channel for expression?
Well, we should always be open to that criticism and really examine how we are presenting our message. And it's difficult. Sometimes I think you can't hook people's interest unless there's some kind of a story that awakens people and makes them at least wonder, now how come, why are all these people sitting in a harbor and they're not being let go, and why are they being confined? And you have to at least tell that story in order to make the hook. But I think that the reality is that many people in the United States have much more access to influencing, and it won't be a huge influence, but some influence will be accomplished, much more access to influencing media than people who are in Gaza, who are getting maybe 4 to 8 hours of electricity during an average day, who don't have the capacity to amplify their voice because they are so isolated. And so but we're the ones who have the tools at our disposal much more easily than people who are bearing the brunt of the wars. And so it's a criticism that should be listened to carefully. I sometimes say to myself, you know, if you wait till you're perfect, you're going to wait a very long time. but really, we have to be open to that criticism and then go back to the drawing board and look at what we've written and see if it's self-serving rather than amplifying the voices of people whose voices we're trying to bring attention to in the first place. But, you know, on the other hand, having some kind of a story that awakens people is part of the political process in the United States.
That's so very true. I remember sitting with the founder of this radio program, Sharif Fahm, many, many years ago, and I remember her turning to me and saying, well, do you think that Palestine will ever be free? And, you know, there was such pain and anguish in his voice. And if you had known Sharif, he was very dedicated, committed. There was no one more passionate than him about Palestine. And, you know, he also said to me, does anything we do, does this radio show, does it make a difference? And in light of those type of questions, how can people who care about Palestine and care about what's happening in their world keep their spirits up in the face of such oppression and injustice? And I know you have a long history of working against war and oppression. What insights do you have to give to our listeners today?
Well, there's a woman named Muriel Lester whom I've admired a great deal. She was a British activist, and she put it quite bluntly. She said, which side do you want to be on? Would you rather be on the side of the fat cats, that was her phrase, who are profiting from wars and promoting wars all over the planet? So one of the things that I think helps keep spirits up is just a humble, grateful recognition that in doing the kind of work that we're doing, and maybe, you know, all of us are only planting seeds and it's another generation in the future that we hope would, you know, reap a harvest, but you get the opportunity to rub shoulders with some of the finest people in the world. I mean, I certainly felt that even when I was in Gaza and it was under bombardment, I was living with a courageous family and, you know, young university students were guiding me walk through the areas that had been bombed after the bombing ended, and I thought, these are some of the finest people in the world, given the trauma they've been through, that they're able to be as resilient as they are, and in fact, to overcome bitterness as well as they did. So I think humble gratitude and finding kindred spirits amongst people that you're really fortunate to be with is one thing that helps kind of put wind back in one's sails and keep going. And then, of course, there's just the very utilitarian calculus that I mentioned before. You know, we have at our fingertips, many of us, several computers in our homes and these whiz-bang BlackBerry phone deals that you can take on the road with you and increasing capacities for social media. And so if we're sort of sitting on top of all kinds of resources, why ever in the world, given the comforts that we have comparatively, I mean, when I'm in a place with no electricity, you know, you do your best to adjust, but I'll tell you, it takes me 8 seconds to get adjusted to electricity when I come back home. You know, the lights are on and the computers are whirring, and I grow very, very accustomed to the pampered and luxurious life relative to where I've often been if I've gone to particularly to a war zone and to places where there's intense impoverishment. So given that we have all these resources, and it's purely by accident of where we were born, it's not like we did something to earn it that others wouldn't have been able to accomplish had they had the good fortune to be born into an area where you know, we're so protected from abject suffering. So use those resources. And so the other thing I learned in Iraq, sitting at the bedsides of children who would never go home and whose mothers were trying to adjust to the reality that they would eventually carry this beloved child to a cemetery. And they had more children that they hoped might survive. And I realized, these women can't afford my despair. And I think that's true of many people who are trapped in the war zones, whether it's in Afghanistan or in North Waziristan or in Gaza, where United States weapons are pounding away, or weapons that we've given to other governments like Israel are pounding away. The people there can't afford our despair. We're the ones who are, you know, directly responsible.
And that's so very true. And unfortunately, we've run out of time. But I thank you so much, Kathy, for joining us today and sharing your voice with us. And we wish
thank you. Thank you, Justina. I wonder if before saying goodbye, could I just mention the phone number that your listeners could call?
Sure.
The State Department Operations Center is open today, and it's 202-547-4000, and that's the number that could be called to appeal to the State Department to free the boat that's still docked in a military harbor.
Thank you so much for reminding us of that. Best of luck in your future endeavors. Take care.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi, everyone. Welcome again to This Week in Palestine. My name's Ken Barney. And each week we bring you this 45-minute program, news and discussion about the struggle of the Palestinian people against this colonization and ethnic cleansing of their land. Now, this is a horror story that's been going on for more than 64 years. It's called the Nakba. Our perspective is, of course, not what you're going to find in the mainstream media. This program was created by the late Sharif Fahm, and all of us are continuing to mourn the loss of our friend Sharif. He produced the program for many years, and now a small group of us are keeping the program going in his memory. Now, today, we're very fortunate to have with us by telephone Ridgely Fuller. She's our friend and fellow Boston area activist. She just returned from Greece, back from the Great Flotilla Initiative. This is Flotilla 2. A whole long list of internationals made the attempt to go to Gaza with this flotilla, leaving from many European countries. And originally, I think there were going to be maybe more than 15 boats, who wound up with about 12 boats. The one, of course, we are paying a bit more attention to is the boat called the Audacity of Hope. Ridgely was on that boat, and she's back now. So we've got the opportunity to be talking to her. And, of course, on top of what has all happened with this flotilla, we have this great action mainly at the airport in Israel, the Flytilla action, where hundreds of international activists have made the attempt to go to Palestine and have been pretty much stopped, except for maybe about 50 of them. Probably several hundred have been stopped one way or another. Either they've been stopped by the airlines in European countries, particularly Germany and France, especially De Gaulle Airport, and then, of course, those that did arrive in Ben-Gurion pretty much did not get through. They were stopped there with a pretty chaotic and, I think, still ongoing scene in the airport in Tel Aviv. At any rate, we want to talk to Ridgely. Just a word about Ridgely. Ridgely's a local person from Waltham. She's, she's had a career in social work. She's been a Palestinian activist for quite some time now. I think first over there in 2002. She's been over there several times, most recently in April and then in May. And she went back to be sort of our representative, and we're really proud of her, from the Boston area. Although there is another person from Massachusetts who was part of the flotilla, Paki Whalen. But so now we want to talk to Ridgely. Ridgely, are you there?
I am. And thank you so much for having me, Ken. It's just such an honor and a privilege to be on this show and to have represented the Boston area. I really hope that I did an okay job for you all. And I felt really honored and continue to. The welcome back has been as exuberant as my send-off. And I can talk a little bit about that. If you'd like, I'm up in Maine right now, as you might know, and the peace vigil that I attend on Fridays up here had signs out for me for the flotilla to welcome home Ridgely. So, and they pass out leaflets about Gaza and the flotilla. So, you know, our job is to keep this in the headlights, and I hope that we're doing that.
Well, yeah, of course we're doing it. It's happening more in European countries where at least there's a little bit of media coverage. I mean, we're still pretty much shut out from mainstream media, but, you know, here and there cracks are opening up, and, you know, it's been great. People are talking about it, and more activists are learning about it. Mm-hmm. It's too bad that you had to miss 4th of July. I mean, you were over there, and here we were celebrating here, and all of us were down at the Hatch Shell singing all those songs, you know, God Bless America and all that. Mm-hmm. I was trying to keep an eye out for Congressman McCarthy. Uh-huh. Anyway, We're going to, you know, maybe a little later on, you can tell our listeners how you celebrated 4th of July. Mm-hmm. But maybe first, give us a little bit of your general feeling, your general impressions about the whole enterprise.
Well, I think first, you know, people ask me why I decided to do this, participate in the flotilla, and as you pointed out, I've been to the West Bank several times, and I've been to Gaza twice for two real meaningful trips. One was about 4 months after Operation Cast Lead that left over 1,400 Palestinians in Gaza dead and most of the area destroyed. And then I went back last August, and I spent 2 weeks visiting a lot of the families that I had seen the previous year and working with social workers and young adults who were working with children. So I really got a sense of how Israel, through its continued blockade, was not allowing the Palestinians living there to recover from the invasion, much less enjoy basic human rights of economic development, freedom of movement, you know, access to medical care, education, and all those things. So it became really apparent that, the intransigence of Israel needed once again to be looked at in a very obvious and public way. And I think especially then when an American boat decided, or the U.S. to Gaza group got together, and in response both to the ongoing blockade and to the invasion, as well as to the deaths that had happened on the first flotilla, they decided it was really important to have an American boat. And it was named the Audacity of Hope. And I really do. I believe that it was incredibly important to have this ship.
And where'd that name come from, the Audacity of Hope?
Well, of course, it was Obama's book, right? Number one book. I think there's going to be a number two boat named after his number two book. But I think it was certainly very well named, and it was a very appropriate name. But I think for two reasons. One is because much of the world sees America as being so complicit with Israel, which indeed it is on so many levels, but still the American people, I think, have a very different view. Increasingly, the more information they get, the more they realize what is really going on in the oppression of Palestine. I always remember, you know, that 4 months or 5 months after Obama was elected, and there was that poll taken, and that 71% of those who voted for Obama said that America should have a much stronger stand on Israel. And, of course, that has never happened. But so it shows me how the American public, given correct information, is way ahead of our government. And I felt like it was really important that the world and especially the Palestinians knew that there were so many Americans who were in solidarity with lifting the siege, lifting the occupation, lifting the apartheid, and really ensuring that Palestinians will enjoy justice and equality as every other human being in the world is entitled to. So for me, that was a real important move, and I felt like it was important to get on that boat. I think in the future there may not be an American boat, that the Americans who want to participate in these kind of actions will join internationals on other boats, because most of the boats, as you know, are not necessarily owned or, you know, run by one country, but there are multiple countries and mm-hmm. citizens of the world represented on the other boats. So this was a really important experience, and I think that I keep hearing, and you know, being in kind of the eye of it, and I really haven't had an opportunity to process how the world community has or is interpreting the flotilla, but it certainly seems like we were able to keep Gaza on the front page, and there's certainly the power of Israel on the front page for a much longer time. We continue to do that, you know, than if we had simply sailed and been picked up by commandos the way we were being trained to do.
Well, I think so. I mean, in some ways, in a peculiar sense, this was a great success that maybe was not totally anticipated. I mean, you wanted to get to Gaza, I know.
Yeah.
And you all wanted to go. I mean, you weren't going to get to Gaza, but at least get close to Gaza and have all the drama being stopped in the water. But I mean, in some ways, this whole huge story of how the major Western powers prevented essentially working with Greece and putting this pressure on Greece stopped you right there in Athens and in Greek ports. And in a sense, it you may be more successful in dramatizing this whole dynamic of the Western powers' support for Zionism,
right?
And, you know, and their submission to the United States and the Zionist entity. Mm-hmm. In that sense, I think were people surprised at being stopped in Athens?
How did? Yes, I mean clearly we were. You know, because our boat had been inspected, we'd been registered as a pleasure vehicle and inspected as a pleasure vehicle and given every indication that everything was in order. And then all of a sudden we got a complaint, and that complaint, as it turned out, was came from the Israel Law Society. It's a group in Israel, a very right-wing group that could issue a complaint. And in Greece, that was enough to tackle or to instigate another investigation. And so once inspectors came on board and looked around the ship, we had obviously nothing to hide. But then they didn't release any documents saying, you know, what their concerns were. And we could have been waiting there for weeks and months. And I think that was a bureaucratic intent just to keep us there. And actually, what was very interesting is when we finally sailed and we were out still in Greek waters, when we were stopped by the Coast Guard, they read the list of complaints to us in English. So clearly, the inspectors had the list of what they wanted us to do with the boat, but they just weren't giving it to us. You know, I mean, again, I think people talk about this as bureaucratic warfare, and this happened with all the other boats as well. As you know, two of the boats were sabotaged, but the latest word on the Canadian boat that felt like they had complied with all the inspectors' requirements, and they were really getting set to sail, and they were then the captain's license was mysteriously lost. And so, again, they weren't able to sail. So I think, you know, that certainly what this has shown is the reach of Israel in terms of exporting the blockade of Gaza, as well as, you know, literally, I mean, it is also a siege of the West Bank as well, you know, and exporting it to Greece. And as we see through the flotilla that you mentioned, to other countries around Europe, which clearly were complicit and doing Israel's bidding in terms of what Israel wanted. But I think, Netanyahu...
Also, you know, you got to remember, it's not just what Israel wanted, it's what the United States wanted. It's what the European Union wanted.
Right.
It's what the Western powers wanted in their submission. It's not just Israel.
I mean, we were certainly seeing the hand of Israel, that Netanyahu went to the IMF and, you know, asking for funds and support for Greece during this time of incredible debt and economic struggle. And also that we know now that Greece has been offered a natural gas pipeline from Israeli waters, which are probably their same waters that, you know, natural gas has been discovered off the coast of Gaza. Of course, they can't access this, and this is part of what's being offered to a pipeline to Greece from Israel.
Yeah, I know, you know, a lot, there's going to be more said in coming weeks about this whole analysis of what happened. And I know people, including media, Benjamin, you know, immediately jumped on the idea that because of the crisis with the Greek economy, that that's a big part of the reason that this happened. There may be something to that, but I think some of us would still argue that Greece is part of, you know, it's part of Europe, and the and that even without the crisis in the in their economy, that there that something like this probably would have happened, you know, even without this crisis. So again, there's going to be a lot more said about that. Actually, wanted to ask you about. About the embassy, supposedly there were communications received directly to some of you that the U.S. embassy was directly involved in giving messages to the Greeks that those boats should not go.
Yeah, well, first I think you have to understand, and I'm not sure if it's true in other parts of the world, but the U.S. embassy, both in Jerusalem or you know the consulate in Jerusalem, the embassy in Tel Aviv, as well as the embassy in Greece, you know, does not protect U.S. citizens at all, and it doesn't ensure that we're able to use the rights that we're accustomed to, even though they've been so limited in the United States. We still do have few rights here that we were clearly not able to exercise in Greece, and that was, as I understand, even from talking to the Greek police, when we were repeatedly picked up by nonviolently demonstrating in front of both the embassy and the ambassador's residence, that the calls came from the U.S. embassy to undertake that action, that the Greek police had no intention of disturbing us. I mean, the first time this happened was on the night of July the 3rd, when there were a number of Americans engaged in a hunger strike in front of the embassy, mm-hmm. just peacefully at night, and the police came and detained them. Then when I was involved on Independence Day, I discovered where the ambassador lived, which was, and there was a little public park right across the street, and so we set up our symbols and our signs, Free Gaza, End the Siege, U.S. boats, let them go, across from the ambassador's residence, and probably within 15 minutes, there were only six, there was three police cars swooped down on us. And, in the United States, I'm really used to the police giving us 5 minutes to make a decision as to whether we'd leave or not. We weren't given that choice. We weren't able to say we could move back to the our former location. And we were really physically, this is not happening in the United States, dragged to the police car. And then once we were detained, it was very interesting. First, they went through our passports numerous times and took down our names. You know, some of those with us had just been detained not even 12 hours earlier. And then another group of plainclothesmen came in, and one of them said that he was from the international, it was a Greek terrorist squad, and that he wanted to see our passports again because there was new information and that this had come as a request from the U.S. Embassy. And other police, you know, said the same thing, that that they normally would not have picked us up.
Did you get the impression, though, that maybe the Greek authorities and the police would not have normally done this, but it was only because of this tremendous pressure that they were getting from the United States and Israel and from the Western powers?
They told us that. You know, they told us they wouldn't have picked us up if we were Greeks, or if they had, we would have been out of the police station within 15 minutes, and, you know, we were kept several hours, 3 or 4 hours in both times. And, you know, I was very concerned because we had a woman with us who was not allowed to retrieve her medication, and she really needed some medication pretty badly. So there was a medical issue involved, too. But the police from this supposed terrorist squad, you know, he was willing to talk to us in a way that was felt freer than I'd heard in the United States or from others. And we asked him where his training was, and he said from the CIA, from, NSA, and from Britain. And then we asked about Israel, and he said, yeah, they do the training in gas. He told us about a hit squad that, you know, was really aimed to kill, because we had asked him if they would have killed us if they'd been given the orders, and he said he wasn't sure. It was pretty amazing, you know.
Were some of these people sympathetic? Did they seem to be?
Yes, absolutely. As I was leaving the police station, you know, there was a policeman in one of those little guard towers, and I spoke to him. I said, I understand this, that detaining us came from the United States Embassy, the order, and he nodded, and I said, you know, it's not good for Greece to listen to the United States, and he nodded very enthusiastically. So, I mean, this is pretty, you know, common. The police are suffering under that economy as well. I mean, the economy of Greece has really been devastated, and it's as part of they've lost, you know, any kind of sovereignty as part of the EU. And just regular people, you know, their pensions are being cut 35% on this round, and they've already been cut before. So people are really suffering in Greece.
It sounds like you accomplished a lot of education right there in Greece with the Greek people. And I have to ask you, how do the Greek papers respond to all this? What was happening with Greek papers while all this was going on?
That's interesting, because I don't read Greek, so I really don't know. And actually, I don't know if we were paying that well enough attention to Greek papers, but the night of the 3rd of July, when our our captain who had been arrested. I mean, mm-hmm. what was going on in this area called Syntagma Square, which would have been a lot like Tahrir Square in Egypt, you know, where thousands and thousands of people were camping out and having these incredible popular assemblies where they would take votes and have discussions all during the day, and we were allowed to kind of come and talk about the flotilla. We were, and you know, we were given so much support for that. And then when our captain was arrested, people went back to the popular assembly, mm-hmm. and they agreed to have a massive demonstration. And that demonstration just kind of spontaneously happened the next night, which would have been July 3rd. And marched through. We took subways. Nobody paid anything, you know, to get on the subway. It was just hundreds of maybe thousand people who just massively went through the subway system and went down and to all these different places, including the American Embassy and the Israeli Embassy. But so I looked in the paper the next day just because there was a lot of Greek coverage of that, and it was all headlines, you know, and pictures of us on all the front page and all the local newspapers. So I think it was covered in the Greek press in ways that probably we didn't pay as much attention to, because, you know, on our boat we had, you know, when you talk about mainstream media, we had CBS was on there, we had a New York Times reporter on there, as well as we had Democracy Now! That provided a lot of, I understand, kind of ongoing coverage. But I was surprised that NPR, Sylvia Pagioli, came and interviewed us in Athens. We were on a Russian interview by a Russian TV station. So I think in terms of mainstream media, you know, we were more interested in how the flotilla was being trade there rather than in the Greek press. So I was really delighted to see all these pictures, and there was a lot of support.
Yeah, I mean, so I saw your picture on that one video. I guess it was the final, you know, the final little celebration where you were all lined up with all these flags together,
right,
and everybody in a line waving and smiling. And actually, people looked, you actually looked pretty happy.
Yeah.
And you should have been, you know.
Well,
but I noticed, one thing I noticed was a little weird, was that where you were standing, you seemed to be holding a Canadian flag, and I was starting to wonder, well, maybe Ridgely wants to move to Canada. You
but
know?
Canada doesn't want us anymore. You know, they've said they don't want us anymore. So, no, I think that was a measure of the internationalness of the whole flotilla.
Oh, yeah,
is that we just would have stood wherever there was room. And actually, and from that lineup in Syntagma Square, where it had massive Greek drummers. I don't know if you could hear them. But we went down to the Spanish embassy, where the Spanish passengers had occupied their embassy. And that was incredibly exciting. So we walked down there. I guess what had happened, from what I understand, is that one passenger had gone in, or a member of a crew had gone in to talk to the ambassador about mediating to get their boat out of out of the dock to be able to let their boat sail. And during that meeting with the ambassador and looking for that kind of mediation, I think there were something like 20 or so Spaniards came into the embassy and really took it over. And so when we went down there, it was wonderful, the solidarity. And I really wish that the Palestinians that I know, both in the West Bank and in Gaza, had been able to really feel the kind of support and real warmth and love that all these internationals, you know, have, and really believe in this cause of justice and equality so intensely.
But don't you think the messages are getting back, have been getting back to Palestine?
I really hope so. It was encouraging for me, you know, because I certainly work in my little piece of Boston and Waltham, and I had no idea, you know, that the international community, and see, when you talk about the international community, you're talking about the governments that are still in collusion and cahoots and stuff in Israel and working together. But I really believe, you know, that the people of the world, and especially of Europe, have certainly gotten this message. And I had no idea of the amount of solidarity. You know, when you walk down a street in Athens, and again, the protesters there just take over the streets. There's no question. There's no police presence at all. You just walk down the main thoroughfares, and when there are all these songs and chants about Palestine and passerbys and in cafes, and they're putting up the V sign, you know, it's clear that the government of Greece is not reflecting the people of Greece. And it really reminds me of what happened in Egypt. And I think we just have to figure out how to turn our power into real political power.
Yeah, so, maybe one day we'll have those kind of experiences here in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Not for a while.
Well, I think it's changing, though. You know, I mean, I had an email list, and I just assume that everybody always agrees with me, which is way easier assumption to make. And I had people who were much more kind of the liberal kind of persuasion probably than I am, and they were on my list. And they emailed me, and so they had no idea of what was going on with Israel and Gaza. They had absolutely no idea, and that they were really feeling like they're getting important information. So, I really do believe that, you know, we just have to figure out how to keep building on all of this, on all of this change that's happening.
Well, you know, the BDS movement, of course, is leading the way,
mm-hmm.
and this was all part of it.
It is.
And just one more incredibly brilliant creative action.
Yeah, well,
but, I mean, every day people are trying to figure out, you know, how to break open all this false consciousness and ignorance.
Right. Well, before I went in the flotilla, I was in Washington, D.C. with mm-hmm. The Move Over AIPAC conference, and it was held the same weekend as the AIPAC conference itself. And
right.
That's, of course, the Israeli lobby, the main arm of the Israeli lobby. And I was amazed in talking to delegates from the AIPAC conference how they were parroting a line but really had very little knowledge. I mean, some people were really saying there's no occupation of Palestine. Other people insisted on calling Palestinians Pakistanis. And these were, you know, among all of those delegates. So I think that we have to understand the strength of the Israel lobby and how that works in conjunction with our own government. I mean, I'm appalled to realize that during the time that I was gone, is that Massachusetts has signed a trade deal with Israel. During a time when much of the world is looking at divestment, is that our state government is actually implementing an investment scheme. And, you know, I mean, I'm not sure how much people in Massachusetts are aware of this, but, you know, I think, you know, I would suspect that it's because Steve Grossman now is our Secretary of Treasury, and as you know, he was a former president of AIPAC and
That's
still
right.
sits on the AIPAC Board of Directors. And all during his campaign, we kept confronting him at least to put this information on his website because we felt very strongly that Massachusetts had a right to know exactly what interest he was bringing to the job as Secretary Treasurer of the state. And he refused to do that. He refused to acknowledge any of his Israel lobby connections. And I think now, you know, he hasn't even been in office for a year, and we're already starting to see what he intends to do.
In a sense, Patrick's analogous to Obama. You
right.
know, both of them very consciously surround themselves with Zionists.
Well, that you know, Patrick hasn't taken those steps until Steve Grossman now is in power. And Steve Grossman, you know, he led the charge to divest the Massachusetts pension funds mm-hmm. from its investment in Iran, which is costing Massachusetts a lot of money. A lot of research has been done on that. You know, we had $450 million invested in Iranian securities or the stock markets, and it's going to cost us at least $5 million in transaction fees to divest and over $40,000 a year, and this money, you know, could be used for the pensions for our teachers and, you know, state workers. So, and Steve Grossman, although the divestment from Iranian stock market didn't make it into the media here, it was very quiet and done under the radar and right before the, you know, the vacation of the, whatever you call it, you know, when they left, right, I think it was 2 or 3 days before the legislature adjourned. But he was in Jerusalem and talking about it in the Israeli media, saying that he was really looking forward to divesting from Iran. And so it's very clear the direction that I'm very concerned. I don't know the cost that this kind of investment will have for Massachusetts and us as taxpayers, how the money could be better spent. But I certainly think the public should know about it and that that we should have some accountability. And again, you know, most of us are talking about that it's important to divest, as we did from South Africa during the apartheid time, and not be investing. So this will be another challenge for activists and progressives and people of conscience in Massachusetts to look into this.
Of course, you know, we have the same mainstream media problem that they have everywhere, and maybe it's a little bit worse because of the Boston Globe.
You know, I'm not sure what the coverage has been in the Boston Globe or the Flotilla, or, you know, certainly Steve Grossman, when he was running, we wrote numerous letters, and none of them were published, you know, about his background, and none of those are published. So I'm not really sure. You know, they don't provide us with a lot of coverage. I know that subsequent to his election, there was some issue about the money he was raising, and that made it into the Globe, and there was a cartoon, and I actually contacted the writer who had broken the story about him raising money from a variety of sources, and I told him about his Steve Grossman's AIPAC connection, and he hadn't known about that either. So a lot of this is, you know, kept under the wraps, and we have to figure out a way to make the media more responsible, so that taxpayers and citizens, as well as, you know, the public, get to know what the real truth is in terms of how our government's operating.
Yeah, well, this is a real challenge. We're up against the owners and editors of the Boston Globe. I mean, mm-hmm. just to speak of, you know, one paper in one area.
Mm-hmm. I tried several times to get an op-ed published in the Boston Globe.
Well, let me interrupt. Just let me break in a little bit, because we don't have too much time left, and I want to ask you a couple more questions about. I mean, some of the people on your boat were, some of them were better known than others. Mm-hmm. I mean, Alice Walker, Kathy
right.
Kelly,
right.
Hetty Epstein, maybe, mm-hmm. Ray McGovern.
Wonderful people.
I mean, here yeah. in Boston, you're the best known. But so, do you want to say anything about some of your new friends?
You know, certainly Ray McGovern and Ken Mayers from the Veterans for Peace, as well as Nick. But Ken Mayers and Ray McGovern, from the Veterans for Peace, are just outstanding. I spent a lot of time with them. Mm-hmm. Nick was actually more on our well-being committee. He had to deal with hotel reservations and stuff like that, so I didn't get to know him as well. And, of course, Ann Wright, who was one of the Veterans for Peace. But, right. And I do want to mention, you know, that on October 6th, they're going to start the Tahrir Square down in D.C., and mm-hmm. it is a website, and I hope that there'll be a huge contingent from Boston going down, really, to make it our camp out down there and support. So they were outstanding, and they were, I think, arrested or detained certainly in every available time. Hetty Epstein was wonderful. She unfortunately was injured. Her leg, she cut her leg the first night that she wanted to spend on the boat. But her spirit
that.
Is just, you know, and the twinkle in her eye is something that just inspires and gives so many of us such confidence to keep moving on. And so she has, I've never seen a twinkle like that. And, of course, Kathy Kelly is wonderful. She's been doing some writing that I hope people have a chance to read. And she was in that initial press conference before we even sailed from New York. And she's just so expressive.
She and Missy were the two that decided to fly the Ben Gurion.
Right, the Flotilla. And I think
they've either been deported or detained.
Yes, they were deported very quickly. They uh-huh. didn't. They didn't experience the detention. I think they just mm-hmm. were turned around and sent back. But what I'm just understanding is that over 32 people have been detained, and in a very kind of violent way, and they haven't been released yet. Again, you know, these are the airlines. Many people were stopped by their airlines, including Air France, Alitalia, Hungarian airline, EasyJet. Yeah, they couldn't even get to Ben-Gurion, again, which I think shows Israel's, you know, exporting of this embargo and the blockade and just refusal to let any kind of nonviolent resistance or protest or presence in Palestine, whether it's in Gaza or in the West Bank.
Well, you know, the Western powers submitted. Those airlines submitted.
Yeah, they certainly did. I don't know if anybody expected the airlines in the home countries. And I guess in France, the police were even told not to take complaints from passengers who weren't able to board Air France. So, I mean, it's very clear. And I think, you know, that the citizens, the residents, people of the world really begin to realize, you know, who's in control and what we need to do in order to exercise basic rights on our own behalf and the behalf of others that don't have the privilege that we do. So, you know, that's certainly a story that's still unfolding. I understand there are internationalists in Ramallah and Bethlehem now that are doing nonviolent protests that certainly illustrate the same way we were illustrating that our presence in Palestine is a nonviolent one and that we have no intention of you know, jeopardizing anyone else's security. It's just making our presence and I think standing in solidarity with Palestine, which is, I think, what the flotilla ultimately did, is it really showed the world that much of the world stands in solidarity with Palestine. And that's an important message. You know.
Right. And, of course, you know, I know I'm repeating this, but, you know, you're quite right about that. But at the same time, the Western power governments are certainly not in solidarity with the Palestinian people.
Right.
In fact, they're supporting Zionism.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the difference and the split between governments and the people is just becoming more and more apparent. And, of course, I'd recommend everybody read Shock Doctrine. But clearly what's happening in Greece and in much of the world, in the United States as well.
Yeah, well, you know, you've done a great job, and, I mean, it's just going to continue on. Actually, there's going to be a lot more writing about this. You know, we're just hearing the first part of this. There's going to be a lot more follow-up and analysis and writing.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, for example, Alice Walker, I'm sure we're all looking forward to what she's now writing about this.
Right. Yeah, she's amazing. She's just, I mean, she's the one who
did you
who
get
really
to talk to her a bit?
A lot. She was just wonderful, you know, and I think her kind of analysis of, because as you know, all we were taking was letters from the United States to the people of Gaza, solidarity letters, and so ours was a mail boat, and she said, you know, the IDF coming after this mail boat is like sending a dog after the mailman, you know, that we were so harmless, and she has such a beautiful way of capturing that kind of spirit. So she certainly was a very important spokesperson for us in many press conferences, and will continue to be, especially as she talks, you know, about this movement as being similar to the civil rights movement in the United States or the Freedom Riders going south, not knowing what happened to them, but knowing that it was an important issue and that the equality throughout the world is something that's worth sacrificing well-being for those of us who are more privileged.
Yeah, well, we'll be hearing more from her, more from you, and more from everybody about this. Especially this whole matter of how the messages were transmitted to these governments, whether it was done through the American embassies or Israeli embassies, or I mean, maybe that's not so important, but I think there's got to be a whole lot more said about all these, disgusting connections that were made very directly and probably not even secretly by maybe some of them secretly between the various governments to stop you folks. Are you are you planning to have more interviews or talks or what's coming up for you?
Well, of course, for me, the commitment is to keep informing people about what is going on with Palestine and the oppression the Palestinians have faced for so many years. And so, you know, that's my commitment. And however I can make that happen, I really welcome the opportunity. First, I think your listeners should know is that next Sunday I'll be at the community church, and then the Tuesday, so that's the 17th, and that's around 11, it'll be on the internet. And then Tuesday evening, probably around 7, I'll be at the Cambridge Friends meeting, and I'll show some pictures. And again, we can talk about the flotilla in terms of how successful was it. It certainly ended in a way that, or hasn't ended, it proceeded in a way that we hadn't anticipated at all, even though I think there probably were signs. I remember in Cambridge talking about one of the questions being whether we would even be allowed to sail. And and I think in Haaretz, you know, there was a lot of articles saying that that the Greece of May of 2011 is not the Greece of May of 2010, that a lot has happened in terms of the Greek economy as well as the overtures that Israel has made. Netanyahu went to Greece for the first time. I think that an Israeli Prime Minister went visited Greece in many, many years, and so that was in February of 2010. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the things that's interesting is that Greece is still very much reacts to Turkey, and there's a lot of animosity still between those two countries, and that's a split that can be exploited by Western powers, and certainly, you know, it was by Israel. For example, a lot of the tourism that used to go to Turkey now is being directed to Greece. And this, you know, Israeli tourism is now being directed to Greece. So there are a lot of ways that splits can be widened and maintained and used to the advantage of, as you say, the Western powers. I mean, we know how successfully the United States has done that in Iraq in terms of the Shia and the Sunni, and as well as in Afghanistan. You know, that splitting populations and countries is something that we seem to do very well.
Yeah, well, we're probably going to have to stop pretty soon. I mean, there's still a lot more to say, and we're keeping our eye on those two boats, the Tahrir and the the Giuliano, the Swedish-Norwegian ship. We know the same thing is going to happen to them. They're going to get stopped.
The Tahrir, again, the captain's license has been lost. The French boat, there is a French boat out there, and some people are hoping that, you know, there's a boats are coming from South Africa that will
But,
you know,
mention that.
And I think some of these boats, including the Audacity of Hope, will be sailing around the Mediterranean with our letters aboard. It will be going into ports in around the Mediterranean doing education information about Gaza, about the flotilla, and we will be waiting for the next opportunity to free the seacoast of Gaza. You know, the Greek people are horrified by Israeli control of the Mediterranean. They told me over and over again how for thousands of years the Mediterranean has proudly been free for all seafarers, and that this really strikes to their core, being a seafaring nation, that that Israel is assuming control of how the Mediterranean is being used. So. Mm-hmm.
We've run out of time.
Great. Well, it was awesome talking to you, Ken, and I just thank the Boston community so much for all the love and support, and they've given me a lot of confidence. So I thank you.
Well, you know how much we appreciate you, and you know, we'll have more of a chance to talk with you.
Awesome.
With upcoming stuff.
Great.
So you take care. We'll see you soon.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Ken, and thanks a lot. Have a great Sunday. It's beautiful up here. Take care.
So, okay, to our listeners, reminding you that you've been listening to an interview with Ridgely Fuller, a local activist who just returned from Greece, where she was part of this great flotilla action that you just heard about, on the Audacity of Hope with all those other Americans. And, we know that this voyage to Gaza may have been temporarily stopped by the submission of the Greek government to the U.S. and the Western powers, all continuing to submit to Israel and Zionism. But the struggle goes on. The people aboard these boats and this flotilla and future flotillas, they're going to get to Palestine eventually. They'll get there, and most important, at some point, the Palestinian people will return to their land, the whole land of Palestine.